Parents were friends.
There was a red Volvo involved.
That's right. And Rebbe Sonnenstein is a very well-known speaker within our community, within Anger Jury, and worked for many communal organizations now. So Rebbe Sonnenstein of Western Marble Arch Synagogue, and we're so thrilled that she's here, and we're delighted and looking forward to her presentation. Are you making all the way
How much time do I have before I start?
Yet. We have a sharp end at 10 o'clock.
Okay, great. So not 3 minutes. Thank you, Julian. All right. So I'm going to speed through the first half, and then we'll spend more time on the second half. Basically, I love clothing, and in order to justify my love of clothing to both my parents and now my husband, I had to do all this research to say why clothing is important. And it really is. It is so important. Often it's seen as frivolous and just something we should all just put something on and get out the door. And yet it's so much more powerful than that. So I can find 9 different reasons clothing in general is important. There's so many more, but let's just do this quickly. It connotes your social status. It has your cultural affiliations, your profession, and often your religion. So it kind of is a straight up identifier. You see someone, how they're dressed, it tells you something about them. The further away we get from the 19th century, the harder it is to tell. The more we're all blended, it's very hard to walk down the street and see someone's cultural dress. Religious dress is still something that you see quite easily, but the people who choose to dress in a religious garb do stand out in a way that in previous generations they wouldn't have. Social status, again, used to be very easy to see, upstairs, downstairs, for those of you who spotted my little Britishism there. So it was much, much easier, and also people had fewer clothing. As of this year, most of us will purchase 58 items of clothing during the span of a year. Only 15 years ago. Yes, obviously. Only 15 years ago, it was about 12 items of clothing. You were purchasing one item a month. With the advent of fast fashion, we're up to about 58 is the average, which is a huge amount, which goes on to a completely different. I didn't go into that depth in the study, but you're welcome to find out. It also often reflects inner values. So again, faith is someone's inner value. One of the best ways are if you are in a rebellion or an adherence to norms. I thought that was a brilliant picture. Someone who's expressing rebellion against someone who is dressed in the norm or what was considered the norm. So dress really, it's the first thing you see, to ignore it at your own peril. It expresses individuality. It also is used as a transformation. In the story of Cinderella, it actually goes up and down. She sews her clothing from her mother's leftover gown. The mice help her. The stepsisters tear off her gown. The fairy godmother then dresses her, and then at midnight turns into a pumpkin and back into rags. And then when she is vindicated, she is back in princess uniform. So the arc of the story, you can tell the story by the clothing. And in 1947, Dior launched something called the New Look, which was in parallel to the austerity of World War II. This is a new era, and you could see the size of Princess Margaret's skirts. They're huge. It's something you would have never been able to do during an austerity period. They also connote transformation times, marriages, military uniforms, or in Dreyfus's case, when they tear off the epaulets of his uniform when he's accused of being a spy. If anyone has ever read Into Dreyfus, Robert Harris wrote a brilliant fiction/real life. He kind of weaves them both in. Brilliant, brilliant book. And then when someone in our faith does Kriya, here you go. So it's a transformational moment, and we use clothing to do that transformative moment. It also puts you in different sectors of society. I haven't watched The Handmaid's Tale. I did read the book, but the costumes tell you where in society someone sits. And then I thought this was brilliant. This was from the Oscars this year. All three people attended. And the first is director Troy Quayne, and his little thing says protect trans kids. The next is Avi Arad, who is wearing the yellow loop, and the last one is Billie Eilish, who is wearing the ceasefire now. So clothing does tell you a lot about people's inner values. There's Montana Tucker, which was in Sanua for any shul setting, wearing a gown, and she has a huge yellow loop on the front of her gown to the Grammy Awards. And this is actor J. Smith Cameron at the Golden Globes, the same way where Montana Tucker is, and she's wearing the blue of the to connote the Israeli flag, and again, the loop, which is meant to stand out against the blue. Incidentally, the loop has always been around. We've adopted it, but the loop is something growing up in the States, trees were tied with loops when you knew that there was a veteran inside or someone who was in the military. Often the family would tie a yellow ribbon around the tree in the front yard. So this is something that we've taken on board. It's not Jewish, it's meant to be a universal sign of prisoners and hostages. How does this connect to Judaism? Basically, I just want to show how important clothing is to everyone. There is no one who remains neutral. It's impossible. Even the way you're dressed, every one of you, if you go into a different setting, you are no longer neutral. Right? It's just depending of where you're around. You'll see Beis Yaakov girls walking around. You take them into JFS, they're no longer neutral, right? Or you take a JFS kid into Beis Yaakov, and they're no longer neutral. You're neutral in your own setting, but the minute you go outside it, so you do say something with the way you dress. And the Torah does get into dress a lot. And again, we shouldn't ignore it. So before we go into the biblical stories, let's find out a little bit about fabrics that the biblical people would have had. It's a goat. It's a cashmere goat. The reason I, in case anyone's buying jumpers at the moment, why is cashmere more expensive than wool? Because cashmere goats have very long hair. It makes a better yarn, and it makes it stronger and softer. You can see how soft the goat's hair looks, as opposed to wool, which is a much shorter fiber. It's much coarser. It makes a coarser sweater. Just in case someone comes to you with a bill for a cashmere sweater or coat, now you know. What fabric is available to the people of the Bible? You've got two, and that is it. Any guesses what the two are, Rabbi? Two fabrics available. Wool and linen, right? That's it. There is two other options, but they were primarily not available to most people. Wool, you could get from a goat or a sheep. The people of biblical times are shepherds, very easy to get wool. They could also get skins off the animal after they've sheared it and butchered it. Not while they're alive, but there's the animal's entirety of the animal would have been used, so that's available. Good. The next thing we have is when they start planting in agriculture, you get linen. Linen comes from flax. If anyone's ever driven from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv and you see a field of what looks like yellow flowers, those are flax seeds. They are fields of flax, and flax incidentally originates in the Mediterranean and Southwest Asia. So this is where flax comes from, and very quickly they figure out how to use flax to make linen. Those are the two fabrics available. If you happen to be very wealthy and you have good trading with the Phoenicians, who live from northern Lebanon down to where is today Netanya, you can get silk from a mollusk. There are all these different types of mollusks. We'll get into them a little bit more in 1 second. But one of these mollusks secretes silk. It's laborious, it's time-consuming, it's very, very expensive. And in terms of cotton, the first time we hear of cotton is in Megillat Esther, in the Book of Esther. One of the things available is cotton. It is believed to have come from China to Persia. It has not made it all the way to ancient Israel during the time of the Bible. So shatness is the only two available fabrics. There was nothing else to add in. So if anyone asked you why these two, because that's all there was. Colors, now that we did that. There are three colors available to the ancient people, and that is it. There are no other colors. So there is red, which comes from the shells of insects. So you smash the insect, their shells are red, and you get red dye. The next one is purple, argaman, and blue, tchelet. Argaman and tchelet, and you have white from pale animals and black from dark animals. It wasn't really white, it wasn't really black, it's somewhere blackish, whitish, and linen in its pure form is kind of off-white. Those are the colors, there is nothing else, and again, the blue, the tchelet, and the argaman, and these are available colors. They're all secreted by mollusks, again, by the Phoenician people who live on the coast. Anyone ever heard of Tyrian purple? So Tyrian purple is what kings wear. It comes from the city of Tyre, which is still in it's just north of Beirut, and that's where Tyrian purple comes, royal blue, because the only people who could afford blue or tchelet were royalty. This is how expensive and laborious it is to get these colors from the secreted mollusks. So those are our colors. So we did fabric, we did color. Let's do ornamentation.
You take a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Did they not also have brown? The Torah speaks about Yantos flocks having the chum.
So brown, whitish, blackish, you have somewhere in between. It's really whatever color is available from the natural hair of the animal. And some of you will be familiar with the word yerak rak, which is green, but that's only associated with sarat, which is leprosy, and it would have been on the homes. It is not associated with clothing. These are colors associated with clothing. Brown is excellent. Yes, it's a combination. So you can use these colors and combine them and get blackish, brownish, whatever color the pelt of the animal would be. Yes?
Talking about shatness, but wasn't shatness just the wool of sheep and flax rather than cashmere and flax? Was that
It's the same animal. It's just, it's
a goat and a sheep. It was okay.
It's wool.
All wool, okay.
I believe, don't quote me, but I believe that it has to do with wool, not sheep's. Like, I don't know that the Torah would have necessarily made that distinction, but I may be wrong. Collars and cuffs. So in order to make any item of clothing more luxurious, more beautiful, the only place that would have been decorated is the cuff, the collar, and the hem of the clothing for very practical reasons, because you would have added something like gold or a blue stripe or a red stripe, something. But when you wanted to launder it, this very expensive dyed piece of clothing would have been too expensive to launder. You would have taken off the hem or the collar. You would have maybe washed it separately, and then you would have really laundered the main piece of fabric. So the hems and collars of things were beautiful well into the early 20th century, where you still have people who have stiff collars that they attach to the cotton or the linen of their shirt, and they're washed separately because they're made of a different fabric. They're more expensive. They're what you see. And hems are so important that they connote social status and they connote wealth. So the Kohen Gadol would have had those bells and pomegranates on the hem of their clothing. Again, if you want to launder it, you need to pick it off, launder the item, and then reattach it. incredibly practical, but incredibly important. And we know from Mesopotamian people of biblical times that to them, the hem was so important that when they were doing exorcisms, they would take someone's hem and sacrifice it in order to exorcise the evil. This is a pagan ritual, not something we would do, but this is part of understanding how important hems were to social status. All right, the people, the Hebrews of the Bible, so the earliest representation we have of them, you can all go visit this at the British Museum. This is the black obelisk of Shalmaneser III, and what you see at the figure at the bottom is, his name is Yehu, and Yehu is the king who then comes to the Assyrian king, and he is bowing down before him, and he brings with him 13 porters, and all these porters are bringing gifts to the Assyrian king, and what you see them wearing are the typical clothing of the people of the Bible. And now the words are going to sound familiar to you because they're words we use in Hebrew today, but they mean different things in the Bible. So the first thing we have is what's called a simla. In Hebrew, that means dress. In the Bible, it means a big rectangle of cloth, something like a sari that you drape over yourself. So the Jews, they all wore this simla, men and women, and you would wrap it around yourself, drape it over your shoulder. You can see they've draped it over your shoulder. Often they would put their bowls and things and carry it over their shoulders. So this is a way of carrying. It's used as a blanket. It's this multifunctional piece of cloth that everyone had with them. Keep in mind, it's a rectangle. We'll get back to that in a moment. Underneath the simla, they would have something called a chagor. We still use the word chagura, belt, today, and it was a loincloth. Very simple. And then the last piece of clothing is called a ketonet or a me'il. Ketonet in Hebrew means robe, me'il means coat. That is not the way it functions in the Bible. In the Bible, it's the item of clothing you wear underneath. It's the basic dress. Men and women wore it. It was fashioned differently for each. And you could see here also at the British Museum, this is the black obelisk dates from the year 842 before the Common Era. This is the Lachish war, wall reliefs, and the year is 701 of the Common Era. When the Assyrian armies come to invade Jerusalem, they actually don't get to Jerusalem. They get to Lachish. You could still go to Lachish today. It's on the southern road to Jerusalem, like Kiryat Gat-wise. And when they get to Lachish, they actually decimate Lachish, and they take all the people of Lachish prisoners, and you could see them, and they're wearing only the kutonet, and it's short-sleeved, this one, and it reaches down to the ankle. So it could have been any length, from knee to short to long, from, you know, short sleeveless to long sleeve, but this is this basic dress. I actually sized it down. It's a horrible thing to see. Like, if you actually look at all the images, they're being tortured in the images. You could go to the British Museum today and see it. It's actually really, I find it, even though it's very flat, it's quite disturbing. And basically the Assyrian king says, I am the ruler of all these people, and this is what I did to them, and it's engraved in language. So basically we've done fabric, we've done color, we've done ornamentation, and now we finished with the items of clothing. Let's wrap it all up in, we're good for time still, biblical stories. The first one, the most shul appropriate image I could find, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. So we always think of the story, and the story being that the big punishment was childbirth and work. And I would like to add a third punishment, clothing. To me, clothing is the third punishment in this. No one specifies it as such. But prior to the sin, they're unaware that they're naked, right? They have no knowledge. They are who they say they are. There's no hiding anything. And then all of a sudden they sin and they become aware and they become ashamed and they use fig leaves to cover themselves up. This is now forevermore going to be a tool in humanity's arsenal of things we use. And God is aware that this is a difficult tool, and he calls it the word beged, which comes from the Hebrew root, that the same word for bagad, which is deceit. And you will see throughout, especially in Bereshit, and this week's parsha is just part of that story, where clothing is used in a deceitful manner over and over and over. So it just keeps on happening. So clothing is a powerful tool in deceiving and revealing. So we have this, but I think what's important to note is just before Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden, God dresses them as a chesed in skins, which is showing you the clothing itself is neutral. It's what we do with the clothing. Like everything else, food is neutral. That, like, it's what we as humans put onto the clothing that makes it either something to reveal or to hide. And I think it's, to me, where the entire story of clothing and Judaism in our narratives begin. So did the name Beged come first, or did the deceit come first, chicken and egg? To me, it's all part of, and parcel of clothing. So we then go from Adam and Eve. We have Noah after the flood, and he is revealed and hidden in his shame. We have Jacob this week. It is incredible that everything that happens is that trajectory, like Cinderella, happens with clothing. So we have Rebecca, who encourages Jacob to dress up as Esav. His father is not convinced, and six different times in this past week's parsha, he says, come closer, because something is not sitting right with him. And then he feels, and that's where the deception goes. How do we know that the Torah had a problem with this deception? That he then goes, firstly, it ends up really badly. He has to run away to Lavan. And what does Lavan do to him? He deceives him, again, with clothing. He dresses up Leah as Rachel, and he deceives him. And when Jacob asks, why did you do that to me? He goes, in our home, we don't put the younger before the elder. So it's like a measure for measure, very Shakespearean, where we put, you did this, I'm going to do this back to you. And clothing, yet again, is used in the deception. So it keeps on going. These layers happen. And let's get to perhaps the person who is most affected by clothing. So we're going to take all the knowledge that we learned and put it into Joseph. The reason I used both Donny Osmond and Jason Donovan is because I saw them both. they were excellent. So thank you, Andrew Lloyd Webber, who wrote Joseph and the Technicolor Dream Code at the age of 17 as his A-level project, just to make the rest of us feel a little inadequate. Was it multicolored, now that you know what colors are available to us? Not. What is the Hebrew word used for his coat? Pasim, stripes, not tzva'im, colors. Right? It was a striped coat, not a colored coat. Yes, in order to create stripes, you do need more than one color. So he would have had blackish, whitish, brownish, whatever it is, and potentially red. Not blue, not purple, because where did Joseph and co, and Jacob and co live? They lived in the Negev. They lived very far from the Phoenician coast. Yes, they would have traded with them, but how much are we going to spend on this coat? Maybe that was the thing, but potentially it was a stripy coat of 2 to 3 colors maximum. That's it. So why are the brothers jealous? They all had the ability to have a stripy coat. So potentially it's given by his father. The Ibn Ezra has a different analysis. One sec.
Perhaps it was bespoke.
It was. You and the Ibn Ezra on the same level there. So what was bespoke about it? Ibn Ezra says it had long sleeves. That is what the brothers were jealous about. Because when you go, for those of you who ever wash dishes, what's the first thing you do?
Roll up your sleeves.
So what does a long sleeve coat connote to the other brothers? You don't have to work. You don't have to wash up. Exactly. So he comes out to the field. The brothers are all there, and they see him in his stripy coat, which either they know or don't know is gifted by their father. So that could be potential where the jealousy is. But as we said in the very beginning, the first thing you see is the clothing. They may not have known, but what they would have seen is that it's long-sleeved, according to the Ibn Ezra, and that long sleeve created jealousy because, remember, if Yosef already told them, they're all going to bow down to me. So he's already elevating himself, and this coat elevates him even further. So with great thanks to Andrew Lloyd Webber, it was not Technicolor or Dreamcoat. Yosef does not escape coats unharmed. The next part, and again, they keep on going. Potiphar's wife, she tries to seduce him. He runs away. She grabs his coat. And then when she accuses him, she uses the coat as proof. So the coat keeps on going. Later on, when Yosef presents himself, when the brothers come, they don't recognize him. Is it because of his clothing? Is it not? But like this theme of clothing keeps on going. I will do this in a PG manner, the next part. Tamar and Yehuda. So Tamar, I'm trying to reframe this. Pardon? You all got it. Okay, great. So she uses a veil to disguise her identity, but veils are used by women in mourning in biblical times and by women of her profession. So there, or the profession she professed to be in. So she's using a veil in order to disguise her identity, and that veil enables her to do what she did, and she then uses the assurances that Yehuda leaves her, his staff, his ring, and potentially a belt, a chagor, or the Torah, it says cord is the best explanation, and she then uses clothing to perpetuate what she does in order to fool him. So the word bagad is perfectly suited, beged bagad, to this incident in the Torah. So we can see how clothing really affects the running of Bereshit. So that's Bereshit. We get into Vayikra, and we've got the Kohen Gadol. And far from being frivolous, the Torah spends, and you can see every single pasuk, like the detail that goes into the Kohen's clothing is beyond anything. And I want us to concentrate on the blue underneath, the sleeveless coat, that me'il, right? This is as everyone in Israel would have worn, this kutonet or me'il, and it's made entirely of blue. Why is that relevant now that we know how expensive blue is? This was the most expensive garment in Israel. This is it. It doesn't get more expensive than this. Also, it should let you know that the Jews who are for 40 years in the desert weren't isolated, because how do you get blue from the Phoenicians if you're not trading, if you're not communicating with other people? I always have my image of them being completely isolated in the desert. They couldn't be, because how do you access this type of material? How do you access gold? You know, how much did they actually bring with them from Egypt? They're accessing it somehow. So he's made entirely of blue. Pardon?
They collected again at the sea.
So they collected the sea, but they're also, they must be talking to other people. We know that they're fighting with other people. So there is some sort of, exactly. So in my mind, maybe the rest of you were already open to this. They were isolated. They weren't talking to anyone. They're in this like COVID haven for 40 years, you know, socially distancing themselves. They're completely in blue. He's completely in blue. We know the hems again, right? The hem has the decoration. And this is what I find extraordinary about the way Jews take dress and take all those things together. Is this, the tzitzit, right? So I explained to you the simla, which is this rectangle, which everyone would have worn, and I do apologize that this mitzvah is all about men, but we're here to talk about clothing, and that's where we're going to focus. So there's a four-cornered garment, and you're told that on any four-cornered garment, on the hem, which is the most important part of the garment, you are going to add a fringe. And in that fringe, you're going to add a string of blue, the most expensive thing available. So all of a sudden, it goes from just the priest has blue, or just royalty has blue, that royal blue, to every man in Israel has a string of blue. And you're tethered to God through that blue. You are all of a sudden mamlechet kohanim, a kingdom of priests, not an individual, not a priest whose last name is Cohen. Now we're all priests. We're all together in this kingdom of priests. Yes?
Would women also wear a rectangle?
They would have.
Why would they not have?
So I believe it's a mitzvah shazman grama, that it is time sensitive, perhaps. Because you do have to make your blessing, you need to put it on, it's during the day, not at night.
There, you have, if you're wearing a four,
yes,
corner garment, you have to have fringes.
I agree completely, as I started by saying, is that I don't have the research or the background to get into the particulars. My focus was on clothing. So
it's to differentiate men, because you weren't allowed to wear it.
So there is no cross-dressing, but the women would have been wearing, like women today in India wear saris. Gandhi wore a type of sari, so we know men at some point wore them too. Again, I don't want to get into that rabbit hole of men versus women and mitzvahs. That is definitely not my forte. My forte is clothing. And I stay there. So what you have is this incredible opportunity for not royalty. And I think it's something that we see across Jewish history that, you know, royalty comes a little bit later, but no one is above anyone else. There's this uniformity that everyone has the same direct access to God as everyone else. So we take that hem that the Mesopotamians were using in order to, you know, exorcise evil, and the non-Jews are using to show off their wealth, to say actually our wealth is spiritual wealth. We're connected to God through this one thing, which kind of equalizes everyone. Everyone needs to wear the blue. Everyone is part of this togetherness. We get, so that's Bamidbar. We then get into Dvarim, and we have the prohibition against cross-dressing. One second. And we have Tzitzis reiterated. Yes. It's an excellent question, and like everything else in our communities, I last week spoke to a group of non-Jews about Jewish burial practice. We help each other out. We just do. It's did they have a gemach for tchelet? Probably. I would have seen that being something that we would have helped each other out, not necessarily, but probably. And I don't know the exact mitzvahs connected to tzitzis, if it would have been, you know, like, don't bother. Today we don't use tchelet, even though my son has it on his tzitzis. It's something that is very important to him. So this is about the history. This is about the bigger picture of what does clothing mean to Jews. And it's what it means to everyone. What you see, what I'm trying to tell you about myself, is in the way I dress. And one of the things that, in particular, Jewish men wearing this me'il, which would have been their outside garment, not as today that tzitzis are often tucked in, they would have been walking around the town with this outside garment with a fringe that had blue, that connoted wealth, that everyone understood that that blue is very expensive, and it connoted wealth, and it connoted royalty. Everyone wore the simla, and how can I prove it to you? A toga is a simla just worn in a different way. A sari is a simla worn in a different way. And if you've ever seen a priest give a benediction, they have this like little collar thing. That is a, if you've gone to shul and you've seen people have very small talis, imagine that talit shrunk all the way down. and that's what you have. So it's the same article of clothing, but it's gone through many iterations. So basically, clothing to me is something that's tangible. It's something that's still alive today. It's something that we can still relate to. When I teach this, there are another two parts of the course, which is the medieval, where Jews are made to wear symbols in medieval Europe, connoting their Jewishness, and then into modern day, how the community that we have today is by and large supported by people who moved to America, England, and France in the beginning of the 20th century and were part of the garment / shmata trade. And the reason we're sitting in Northwest London today has a lot to do with the people who initially came to the East End and established themselves there.
Sure.
We have 2 minutes for questions. I'm just saying it time-wise. Yes.
Actually tells us, though, to enhance your point, that the Kodim of the Kohen Gadol was the Chavod of the Tiforis, right? So it was to establish, the clothing itself was to establish royalty, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why his Me'il was completely blue.
Great. Absolutely. Excellent point. Thank you. Esther?
Did you say initially that Kisteros was an under thing?
So the kutonet, or me'il, is this very simple shift that you wore as your base clothing.
So how does that match with the striped coat being kisteros?
So it's just this stripe. It's the simla is like, imagine a coat. It's something that you wear on top of the kutonet. So the kutonet, or the me'il, is just the basic... We use the word, so because modern Hebrew, one of the things the Bible isn't great at is that there are too many items of clothing for one word. So like there are 7 items of clothing and they're all covered by one word. So there's a lot of confusion. So we believe it's this undergarment or this everyday garment. It's what they wore, as we saw in Lachish. Let's go back. This is what they're wearing. It's what they're wearing every day. The simla, this wrap, was an extra layer. Even the way we do it today, a talus is an extra layer above regular clothing.
The kisteros in the front of the Mishkan is different. The kisteros passing from Yosef, we're talking about two different...
That's why there's a lot of, like, the Torah isn't interested in fashion. It couldn't care less. It's saying that this was a kutonet pasim, whether it's,
so it may not be a coat.
It may not.
In the sense that it's depicted.
Yeah.
In the pictures.
Yeah, no, again, Andrew Lloyd Webber, great musical.
It changes our understanding of it because, first of all, who needs a coat in the Negev?
Exactly.
And second of all, it's something to be much more jealous of if it's an every single day item of clothing.
Something to note.
Over your clothes.
Something to note. Most people only had one set of clothing. No one had a cupboard, a wardrobe. There wasn't. Like, whatever you're wearing, that's it. There is no other. There's nothing you're saving for best. That's it. Maybe, like... our understanding of clothing is so based on our modern understanding that it's very hard for us to look back and say they had no clothing. One of the punishments in the Middle Ages for Jews who disobeyed one thing or another was to take away their clothes. There was nothing else. Like, they were literally naked. There's nothing underneath. There's also nothing underneath this kutonet. Maybe there's a loincloth at best. There's nothing else.
It was the basic clothing item.
Yeah.
And that to me changes the way I understand it.
Okay, hopefully it expands the view. Yes.
Yeah, I love the idea that in Gan Eden, after the sin, the third punishment, I'm not sure if you're saying if the third punishment was clothing or the need for clothing, because it's exposure to the problem.
Yeah.
Clothing is actually the healing of the insult of exposure. And just like children, children go through a stage where they all dress up, and the need to dress up. And in psychotherapy, you have this idea of defenses, which are kind of unconscious clothing. These things both protect us from exposure, So in a healthy way, but it also harms. So defences can be positive or negative, but they help us develop. So you can dress as a rabbi and you were a human being, but now you can play a different role. It allows that role to happen, or a doctor or whatever it would be. It's protective. You can't be overexposed, because if I was too human as a doctor, then I wouldn't be able to cope kind of thing. So it's like positive, negative.
I think it's the punishments is the responsibility. Now you're responsible. Now you need to be honest. You need to hide and you need to reveal. And it's a huge responsibility. And how you present yourself to the world. Yeah. Is it as a doctor? Is it reveal? Like, there are all these new responsibilities that they didn't have prior to the sin. And just as, work is both a gift and a responsibility.
It's actually the possibility.
Well, hopefully most of us love our jobs, right? Yeah. It's a wonderful thing, but it's still a responsibility.
One question.
Yes.
When Judah left Shalach, he gave her his rap, didn't he, as well as his...
So he gave her his staff, his ring, and what the... Not, so it says cord is the Hebrew. What that cord is it a belt, probably, or something of that nature, but not his outer garment, because he, as we said, there's nothing underneath. He would not have walked out undressed.
Identified him, maybe because also a rich person. Also, Ruth was very poor, but Boaz put the wheat he gave her into her wrap.
And again, hems, Boaz and the hem. Now you'll have a new awareness of clothing when you go back to the Torah, especially in Bereishit, you'll see it coming up over and over again.
Sure.
Thank you all so much.
Can you
tell
me everything
about
the situation
in
Hollywood? That's the first time I see you, and welcome to you. And thanks everyone for coming. Thanks so much for organizing. And there's lots of breakfast and.